He's a member of an American political dynasty, author, activist, environmental lawyer. But will he be the first independent presidential candidate to break through? Robert F. Kennedy Jr. joins me for the hour. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. We're coming to you tonight from Scottsdale, Arizona, where we're devoting the entire hour to a sit-down with my next guest, independent presidential candidate, Robert Kennedy Jr. And I'm pleased to be joined by Robert Kennedy. Thank you for being here. I want to start with this. You are now the highest polling independent candidate since Ross Perot. The question is, and this is, I guess, a criticism as well, your opponents say you're only registered on the ballot in two states. How do you close that gap?
Well, we have sufficient signatures now in nine states. Because the DNC has this enormous operation, they have $3 billion to spend to try to keep us off the ballot. We are not releasing our signatures until the last minute because it just gives them, you know, more targets to hit in a shorter period of time. So we're on nine states. We're going to be adding probably two states or more a week from now on. We won't have any problem getting on the ballot in every state.
You mentioned that DNC operation. I've never seen anything like this. It is at the Democratic National Committee, there is a division intent on knocking you off of the ballot in every state, and they've been contesting you in several states already, including a former White House counsel who's a member of that group. They say you can't get on the ballots and you can't win. You say what?
Well, those are two different issues. I mean, we're clearly going to be on the ballot, and they may believe that they can keep us off the ballot, but I think that belief is beginning to diminish because we got on Michigan this week and they said that we couldn't do that. The hardest ballot to get on is New York, and because it has a very short time window, 45 days, we will have all 45,000 by week three, and we're going to probably end up getting double that. You know, they're mistaken if they think we're not going to be on the ballot in every state.
What does it reveal to you that they're focusing so much money, so much attention, and an entire new division at the DNC to knocking you off the ballot? What does it tell you?
It's ironic.
It's
the Democratic Party. They're supposed to be about democracy. I grew up in the Democratic Party that was fighting for voting rights for Americans. And, you know, now we have a Democratic Party that's fighting to diminish the amount of choice that Americans can have, to diminish, you know, the capacity of Americans to vote for the candidate that they want to vote for. It's almost, and they're very open about it, saying, you know, our strategy is to make sure nobody can run against Joe Biden. And, you know, this is the old Soviet system where the party would actually, it was a kind of faux democracy where the party picks a candidate. Where, you know, everybody criticized Putin for having 88% of the vote because he had no opponents.
Right.
Well, you know, we're doing the same thing.
Them, yeah.
And the, you know, I guess ultimately it's we have to destroy democracy in order to save it.
Is that what you see playing out here, where they're trying to knock you out of contention for the ballot, and they've got Trump tied up in these trials, some of which are stretching of the statutes, to say the least?
Yeah, and I'm against that. I think it's a difficult balance. We live in a country where, you know, we say everybody has to comply with the law, and, you know, mm-hmm. So there's an argument that even if there's a small infraction by a political candidate that you should, you know, or by a president that you should indict and prosecute them. But there's also a balance because we don't want to look like a banana republic where if, you know, where pretexts are used to prosecute political opponents to keep them off the ballot. And this is an old system that the framers understood about. And, you know, listen, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump's, but I want to win an election against him fair and square. I want every American to believe that they had a chance to vote, that the vote wasn't fixed, that the election wasn't stolen, and that because what happens if you make it so that people can't support him and they want to, it just pisses half the country off.
Yeah. Mr. Kennedy, you are polling amazingly at 26% in Michigan. And this has scared not only the Biden campaign, the Trump campaign has started a new website, Radical Effing Kennedy. That's the name of the website. Yet you maintain that they approached you about being President Trump's vice president. They say that didn't happen.
Yeah, it did happen, and it happened on multiple occasions. And, you know, there are many people in that campaign, and there's people in the press, including the New York Times, who's interviewed people on the campaign who have said, yeah, we asked them. So, I don't care about winning that argument or not. I just mentioned it kind of as a paradox. Yeah. But we're, all we need to do is to get to 33% to win the election. Mm. Yeah, you don't need 50%. It's a three-way race. It's really a five-way race. Right. So all I need is to get to 33%, and I'm close to that in a bunch of states. I'm beating President Trump and President Biden among all young people in this country, everybody under 35, in the five battleground states. Mm. I'm beating them among all voters under 45. I'm beating them now in the biggest cohort, which is independent voters. This is the first election in history where independents are the largest political party. 43% of Americans self-identify as independents, compared to 23%. Democrat, 23% Republican, or 27% Democrat, 27% Republican.
Yeah. And yet.
And by the way, we did a poll this week, the most extensive poll ever in this election, almost 30,000 people. It has a margin of error of zero. Our poll shows that if President Trump, Biden cannot beat President Trump no matter what. If I stay in the race, President Biden does better. In fact, he wins two extra states if I stay in the race. But if I drop out of the race, he still loses. He loses either way. If President Biden drops out of the race, I beat Donald Trump. So if people are really concerned about, making sure that President Trump doesn't get elected, they need to convince President Biden to drop out. Now, any vote for President Biden is a vote for Donald Trump.
Okay. Now, your family disagrees, or chunks of your family disagree with that idea. 12 of the Kennedys showed up with Joe Biden.
Six.
Okay. The six that they got, 12 signed the document, I guess, or the statement. But six of them actually showed up for the event in Philadelphia. But your sister said, you are dangerous. Your brother, Chris Kennedy, said, this would not be happening if our father had lived. What does he mean by that? And that had to hurt you. I know you say this is a way to bring us all together civilly. This had to strike your heart a bit, that they're supporting your opponent.
You know, I love my family. I feel that my family does love me. Mm-hmm. I understand why some of them, we come up from a big Irish family. Yeah. We don't agree on anything. And we were raised in a milieu to debate each other, to debate with passion.
Right.
But also to love each other throughout the process. So there, I have five members of my family who work for President Biden's administration. Mm-hmm. President Biden's a long-term friend of our families. He has a statue, a bust of my father behind him at the Oval Office. So I understand why. And my family is very tied in with the DNC.
Yeah.
And, they're all living in this terror, and we're all kind of manipulated by fear these days, and they all live in a terror that if President Trump gets elected, that the Republic will be over. And so to them, they think I'm going to take votes from President Biden, mm-hmm. and that's very dangerous because it could get President Trump elected. But I see, I see things very differently than they do.
Did they call you first?
Yeah.
Have a discussion? They did tell you, we're going to be supportive.
Yeah, and in fact, many of them have contacted me and said to tell me that when they were with President Biden, that they asked him to provide me Secret Service protection.
Why haven't they given you Secret Service protection? Five times they've turned you down.
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, I think the obvious answer to that is that is for political reasons that they feel like I have to spend money on my own protection, and that's costing me $1 million a month, and that they'd rather me be spending that money on security than spending it on advertising or a field organization. I think it's a bad practice. You know, when my father went into the Justice Department, he had a meeting the first week there, reassembled all the branch and division heads of the Justice Department. He said, whatever we do not politicize this this agency. U.S. federal law enforcement agencies is very dangerous to our republic. If we don't look at whether somebody's Republican or Democrat, whether we're going to prosecute them, we go right down the line. You know, I think it's a credit to all of our previous presidents that they've generally done the same thing. I mean, Richard Nixon did try to politicize the FBI and the CIA and the IRS, but there was a tremendous reaction against that. And by the very people who are kind of sanctioning and condoning the liberal media, sanctioning and condoning the politicization of the CIA, the FBI, the IRS, and now the Secret Service by President Biden. I've seen what I think is very, very troubling for our republic that these agencies are now being turned into political instruments by the president in power. It's not good for democracy.
There is a consulting panel that the Homeland Security Department speaks to about who should get Secret Service protection. Have you spoken to any of the members of that panel? I know Speaker Johnson's a member of that panel and other elected officials. Has your campaign or you been in touch with those individuals?
We've communicated with that group, but the call, they're just a recommendation group. Mm-hmm. The call is being made by Secretary Mayorkas and by the White House.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm the first presidential candidate in history that has requested protection and been denied protection. There have been 44 candidates who've been given protection prior to the 120-day mandate. You know, they have to give you protection 120 days out.
Right.
And I'm the first one, and there are 44 candidates who've been given with a tiny fraction of my polling.
Right.
You know, people like Pat Buchanan, who had, 1% popularity, Shirley Chisholm, Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. Pat Robertson.
Pat Robertson. They all got Secret Service protection early. And
given your family history, which we'll get into in a bit.
We also provided them 68 pages of material, of death threats, of actual incidents where people coming with guns to my event and, trying to get into my green room with hidden weapons and fake IDs, fake federal IDs. And then I think 4 break-ins at my house since I announced, including one intruder who got to the second floor when my family was there. You know, what I worry about is if there is an incident that, bystanders will also, in almost all of the big assassination attempts, including my father's, there were 6 bystanders shot. My uncle, President Kennedy, had several bystanders shot. In all of these incidences, you get people who are caught in the crossfire. And, it's important to have Secret Service protection to discourage those things from happening.
Why would your family go stand with the president? Shouldn't they make that the condition to going? If you're going to endorse the president, make the condition, okay, but you have to provide Secret Service protection to our brother. But they come up and they not only stand with the president, they said he's defending freedoms and our freedoms. Your reaction to that?
Raymond, I'm going to give you all of their telephone numbers and urge you to call
go
them.
Go ahead. I'm ready. Terry is
that
one.
Point.
Rory, go ahead.
But I am grateful that they took the time while they were with him to ask him to provide me Secret Service protection, and now we'll see what's going to happen.
Do you think he's a defender of freedoms?
President Biden?
Yeah.
I think he sees himself that way, but we all have this blinders where we judge ourselves by our intentions rather than our actions. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at his actions, that he'd be shocked to see himself the way that I see him. I made the statement the other day that shocked Democrats, where I said that I thought President Biden was that I could make the argument. This is what I said. Mm-hmm. I said I could make the argument that President Biden was as much a danger to the Republic as President Trump. And then I made the argument.
Right.
And, you know, I can lay it out. You know, for example, President Biden is the first president in history to censor his political opponents. And I can say that because I won a case in the federal district court and then that was upheld by the Federal Court of Appeals and is now waiting for the Supreme Court that found exactly that, that 37 hours after he took the oath of office, President Biden's White House began ordering the social media sites to remove me, remove my platforms from Instagram, from Facebook, from Twitter, mm-hmm. to shadow ban me, to slow walk me, to make sure people couldn't see my posts. And that, mm-hmm. you know, we don't want, in our country, we passed the First Amendment of the Constitution specifically to stop government officials from silencing their opponents because we know a government that can censor its opponents, that it is the beginning of a slippery slope that gives them license for any kind of atrocity, that everything begins with freedom of speech, and that, you know, when the government gets involved with censoring speech, it's always, always a bad ending.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get into that whole COVID era, because something clearly shifted in you, which I want to probe a bit. But let's talk some issues. Well, and starting with Israel, this conflict coming from the attack from the Hamas, what would you do if you were president? President Biden wants a ceasefire. He's telling everybody to calm down and that they're essentially good people on both sides. Your reaction to that?
Well, I consider myself, Raymond, extremely pro-Palestinian. So I, you know, believe that the Palestinian people ought to have their sovereignty, ought to have their rights, ought to have freedom, and they ought to have their own nation, and they ought to, be able to experience all the freedom that people in Israel are experiencing. I'm heartbroken by the deaths of civilians in Gaza, but I don't see that Israel, because of the way the international community has behaved, I don't see that Israel has any choice except to eradicate Hamas. I don't. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, conflate Hamas, which is an agent of Iran,
right,
with the Palestinian people. Hamas is a kleptocracy. It steals money. You know, the three top officials, Ismail Haniyeh, who is the senior officer of Hamas, has a net worth of $4 to $5 billion. The top three officials of Hamas have a net collective net worth of $11 billion. Mahmoud Abbas, who is the head of the Palestinian Authority, is a billionaire. This is a kleptocracy. They are stealing the international aid funding that is meant to help the Palestinian people, and the money that they don't steal, they're using to build 300 miles of tunnels, an entire underground city, rather than schools and buildings and economic mm-hmm. development, and to build a port that can make, you know, bring incredible wealth to Gaza, to develop their agricultural lands, which are some of the finest, richest agricultural lands mm-hmm. in the region. They've used that money for one purpose, which is to annihilate Israel. Hamas has in its charter and in every public statement that they don't want land, they do not want peace, they do not want negotiations, they want one thing: the eradication of Israel, the annihilation of Israel, and the destruction of the Jewish people. Mm. So how do you, and in fact, their covenant, which I've read, specifically says in it that any negotiation with Israel is a violation of Islamic law. Mm. So how do you negotiate with somebody? When people say ceasefire, you know, what Israelis hear when they see that, what happened in the last five ceasefires, where Hamas used each of those ceasefires to rearm, to regroup, to raise the banner for another surprise attack. So I don't see, you know, when you say ceasefire, what are you talking about? Because Hamas doesn't want to stop firing rockets.
What would you do about all these protests we're seeing at universities across the country, at the University of Michigan, at Columbia, at NYU, where they're essentially blocking Jewish students from coming to class and occupying public spaces? What would you do if you were president?
Well, you know, first of all, I would have to look at each instance because I am, you know, a free speech absolutist. If people want to protest, I believe they ought to be able to protest. Now, there's a big difference if you're at a public university, which is government funded, mm-hmm. and you're at a private university, because a lot of the private universities have already adopted rules that constrain free speech, which they're allowed to do. It's like mm-hmm. a private club
yeah,
can
private
say,
home, yeah.
don't talk politics in our club. They right. can do that. Or a private home, you can mm-hmm. make those rules. And if you're saying you can't make rules that, you know, that, for example, make black people on our campus feel uncomfortable or feel, you know, mm-hmm. threatened. If you're saying that, then you have to offer Jews the same protection. You yeah. can't. And so I think there's different rule. There's a different set of expectations on those private campuses than on the public. And public campuses, here's what. If you're making somebody feel threatened, you can be prosecuted for that or disciplined. But in terms of just the protests, I wouldn't, you know, I think the protests to me are offensive, but I support the ability of Nazis to protest. Mm-hmm. You know, and I did when they marched in Skokie in 1978. The ACLU, most liberals, said, yeah, what they're saying is appalling, but we have to be willing to die for their right to say it.
But they can't block access of kids because of their nationality or race from going to
school. Yeah, if you're doing that, exactly what you said, mm-hmm. if you're blocking access because of their race, mm-hmm. then that's subject to discipline.
Let's talk about Ukraine for a moment. I know you have a very interesting, almost your own just war theory, where you break out a war of choice as opposed to a moral war. Explain the difference, and does Ukraine qualify?
I consider myself anti-war, and I come from a family. You know, my uncle, President Kennedy, said that the primary job of a president of the United States is to keep the country out of war. My grandfather lost a lot of his friends for protesting World War I, and, you know, I believe that in the last 100 years, there's only one war that we fought that is a moral war, and that would be World War II. Because we were attacked by an implacable enemy that was capable and that was pledged to essentially world domination and the subjugation of all free people, et cetera.
Which is the argument that even some in Congress make about that $61 billion package that went to Ukraine.
Right.
It's a world war. You've got to stop Russian aggression. They're going to move to Europe.
You can make that argument. And, you know, we have these kind of comic book depictions of all the enemies that we want to add to the roster in this, you know, continual pipeline of forever wars. We said the same thing about Saddam Hussein. It was a bunch of lies. We said he had weapons of mass destruction. He did not. We said he sent the anthrax over here, and it turns out it was the CIA, you know, Fort Detrick, where that anthrax came from. We said he bombed the World Trade Center, which he had nothing to do with. And so we have to be very skeptical when we hear these characterizations from the people in power, because they have an agenda, which is to keep this country in a constant state of war. And, you know, BlackRock, which owns Raytheon, was one of the biggest owners of the Democratic and Republican Party. It owns Raytheon, it owns Northrop Grumman, it owns General Dynamics, it owns Boeing, it owns Lockheed. It's making that money that we're sending to Ukraine, it's not going to Ukraine, yeah. It's going to BlackRock. And then BlackRock also has the contract for rebuilding Ukraine at the end of the war. So it's now got, you know, it's digging the hole and then filling it hole and getting paid both ways.
Both ends.
Which happens all the time. The Iranian drones were made by the same American
Exactly.
That made the Israel batteries and took them down. I mean,
yeah,
this is an astounding thing.
It is. And we have to start, you know, to live in a democracy, part of the responsibility of citizenship is to view this and maintain a fierce posture of skepticism towards any pronouncement or claim by government officials, and particularly when they're trying to get us into a war.
Yeah.
We need to say, wait a minute, hold on, let's examine this. If you look at, you know, there is really zero evidence that President Putin has plans for, you know, a global conquest of Europe. He only sent 40,000 troops into Ukraine, and he did it reluctantly. He doesn't want our missile systems 4 minutes from Moscow.
Yeah.
Like we did it in 1962 on Russian missile systems 25 minutes from Washington. And we were willing to go to war for it. Putin has said, and many other leaders, going back to Gorbachev, whatever you do, you cannot put NATO in Ukraine. And when we just said we're going to do it anyway, you know, he sent the 40,000 troops in to get us back to a negotiating table. He offered to settle the war in 2014 with the Minsk Accords. Zelensky actually ran, and that was a peace agreement that Putin agreed to, that France agreed to, that Britain agreed to, that Germany agreed to. Zelensky ran in 2019 promising to sign it, won 70% of the vote, so the Ukrainian people wanted peace. And what happened? Somehow, Zelensky was convinced not to sign that, and clearly the people who convinced him that were Victoria Nuland and our State Department and right-wingers in his own government who threatened to kill him if he made peace with the Russians. And Russia has legitimate reason not to want, you know, they've been invaded three times through Ukraine.
Yeah.
Last time, Hitler killed one out of every seven Russians. So, of course, they don't want a foreign enemy army in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So Zelensky signs the agreement. This is in April 2022. Putin's emissaries signed the agreement.
Right.
And then Joe Biden sends Boris Johnson over to Ukraine to get Zelensky to tear up the agreement because we wanted the war. And since then, now I read yesterday that possibly 600,000 Ukrainian kids have died.
Yeah.
Totally unnecessarily. Hmm. And, you know, and it's criminal what we did.
As we talk about that issue of death, I need to, and tragedy, abortion remains a tense and central issue in this campaign. I need to talk about your evolution on this issue since you've been in the campaign. In June of 2023, you said the first 3 months of pregnancy, an abortion should be allowed, but not after that. In August of 2023, you supported a 15 to 20 week ban. Your campaign said you didn't hear the question and that wasn't correct. In March of 2024, you said abortion should remain the law of the land and accessible to every woman throughout her pregnancy. Now you say you support life and you have this daycare plan. Tell me about this plan and why the evolution.
Well, I came from a family that was divided on this issue. And I had my aunt, Unit Shriver, who was my godmother, with whom I was very close, and she was very much pro-life for most of her life.
Yeah.
And then a lot of my family was pro-choice. So I don't feel that I'm doctrinaire on either side. You know, I feel like I want to listen to people and that I want to respect people's judgment and try to find a place that, you know, a common ground where Americans can agree on it. And, but, you know, I've also been an advocate for medical freedom for, you know, probably more than any other American, probably lay claim to being a bigger advocate for medical freedom than any other American.
Right.
That's because I'm not on the vaccine issues that I think we ought to have freedom, we ought to have bodily autonomy, we should not have government telling you what you can and cannot do.
Do you think it should be a state issue like Trump suggests?
No, I believe that it should be up to the mother and that the woman, it's never, every abortion is a tragedy, everyone is a trauma, but I don't trust government officials or bureaucrats to
no
make
federal
decisions.
Role at all.
I think the mother needs to, that it has to be ultimately the choice of the woman. But here's what I would say, is that I would like to maximize choice, but also minimize the number of abortions that occur every year. And how do you do that? I want to make sure that no American mother ever has an abortion of a child that she wants to bring to term because she's worried about her financial capacity to raise that child. Mm-hmm. I had kind of a revelation when I went to visit Angela Stanton King at Angie's House, which is a place for unwed mothers who were tempted to have abortions because they couldn't afford the baby. Mm. And Angie's House in Atlanta gives them the capacity to bring those kids to term. And I met all these extras. In fact, Angela's own daughter, yeah, who she was urged to abort when she was sent to prison. Angela was sent to prison, and she had that baby, which everybody was telling her to abort, while she was handcuffed to a bed with a sheriff watching her. And that child just won the debating award at Harvard University and is graduating this year from MIT. And that's an inspiring story. And one of the things that Angela pointed out to me was that I think 42% of abortions are with black mothers, mm-hmm, that the abortion clinics are much more likely to be in a black neighborhood and the fertility clinics in a white neighborhood. And there's a fairness issue here. And there's, what I want to make sure is that we have the money that we save on the Ukraine war, we bring some of that home and use that to provide daycare to American mothers. But everybody has a guarantee of daycare, and that actually is going to save us money in the long run because it frees up people to work, mm-hmm, frees up parents to work, but it also makes sure that we.
Do you think that's
it's a recognition that all life is sacred, and that if we want to live up to our ideals as a country, that we need to do everything that we can to reduce the number of abortions that we have every year.
When you look at the surveys, women choose abortion because they say, this is going to change my life too radically and I can't afford this child. So does daycare really, is that really a counter argument or a counter force in the decision?
I think we need to have also the best adoption system in the world. And adoption placement systems in the world so that people have that option as well. And, I think we need to give people every option that they can, mm-hmm, to bring the baby to term, but not force them to make that choice. But give them every option so that it becomes attractive to them.
You once said abortion should be limited up until viability at 3 months. What changed?
Well, I think that's a rational position because, I'm a lawyer, and the way that I look at this is that at some point, at some point it's the mother's child and the baby cannot live outside of the womb.
Right.
But shouldn't that fetus have more rights as it, after it passes that term of viability, at what point does the state step in? If the mother is a crack addict, at that point, the state can step in to protect that baby. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's not an easy issue. And all of these things are things that I think, people can have different positions on. I respect those positions. I think there's a strong argument. I just come down in the long run is that we have to leave it to the mother, that she, the mother, her pastor, her doctor, she has to make those choices that I don't feel comfortable saying that a state or some bureaucrat is going to make it.
Does your faith enter into this at all when you look at this issue of abortion?
Yeah, my faith, obviously. This is it's a biological issue about when life begins, but it's also a philosophic issue. And, but again, I feel like it's a balance of interest in the long run that the mother, that the choice has to be left to the mom.
And not me. Not the life.
Well, not me. I think the mother, listen, no mother, no mother enjoys having an abortion.
Right.
So, we need to leave.
Well, and some have already written congratulating you, saying, look, this is a big movement, particularly someone who is in the Democratic Party. This is a movement to the center on this issue. Here's my question. When I read this entire plan, I'm sitting in front of Robert Kennedy, who spent his life warning the country about medicines the side effects of vaccines and medicines coming from big pharma. Aren't you at all concerned about the abortion pill that is now the primary abortions happening in the United States via these pills? Are you worried about the side effects and the impact on fertility for these women, the long-term effects of those pills? And do you support the Biden administration changing a rule recently to send those abortion pills to every pharmacy?
I'm worried about every pharmaceutical drug. You know, Peter Gosch, who's one of the most influential epidemiologists on the planet, he was the founder, co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, which is 30,000 independent scientists who do clinical trial reviews. And he published a study this week that showed that pharmaceutical drugs are now the primary cause of death in our country. So 5 years ago, he did a study that showed that at that time, pharmaceutical drugs were the third leading cause of death after cancer and coronary arrest. Mm-hmm. Now they're the number one cause of death in our country. And, you know, I think there's all kinds of things that we don't know about the impacts. We take more pharmaceutical drugs than anybody.
At every stage of life now.
And we're the unhealthiest country in the world. And, you know, a lot of the behavioral issues that we're seeing, a lot of the endocrine, the sexual development issues that, you know, that we're seeing, the loss in sperm counts, the early menstruation of girls, the early puberty, many other issues can be trace to these and the violence that we're seeing in our society, the mental illness, the depression, the suicide, the homicide, you know, these are all can be an impact of pharmaceutical drugs. And we know almost nothing about them. Why? Because the pharmaceutical industry controls NIH, CDC, and FDA. And I believe in choice. The issue you raised about abortion pill, I think we ought to know what the side effects are, what the risks are, what the benefits, and that everybody should have an informed choice, and we don't have that now.
Would you reverse that rule that Biden just changed, making this available now, these abortion pills, at Walmart, at Target?
No, I would not do that.
Why not?
Oh, what I'll do is I'll do make sure we do the science so that everybody knows what they're getting and that they can make an informed choice about it.
Okay.
I want to move on. I've got to ask you about this. Title IX, the Biden administration recently changed Title IX, broadened it. Which is the Title IX is protection of women in sports, in education, in society. He broadened it to include biological men who identify as a woman. Would you support that rule change?
You know, my uncle wrote Title IX.
Yeah.
And he wrote Title IX to, and he fought for it for years, to make sure that women's sports could get equal treatment as men's sports. And I'm very proud of what happened as a result of that. I have a niece, who's Cheryl's niece. She's got a full scholarship to BC as a softball player. She worked all of her life to get that place. I don't think it's fair if a boy can walk off a neighboring playing field and say, "I'm a girl now, and I'm going to take that spot that you worked for." And by the way, you know, I think we all need to respect people who have, you know, sexual differences and protect them. But I don't believe that people who were born men ought to be able to compete in consequential sports where there are scholarships potentially at stake or those kind of things against women.
You think your Uncle Jack would agree with you?
You know, I try not to do that kind of speculation because that's just that's a game that every side can play, and they belong to the ages now. They don't belong to me. I think all the things I do are things that my uncle and father would approve of, but I don't justify myself on that basis by claiming their sanction, because it's a logical fallacy.
Let's talk about COVID. I saw a shift in you during that COVID period. What happened there when you saw the suppression of information, the demonization of science and scientists, a renowned epidemiologist that you and I know, infectious experts, were just pushed aside because they dared to contradict the official line that was coming out of D.C. at the time and out of the NIH.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really, was exasperating to me, that kind of captured, you know, all of the, everything, the mischief that was going on, which was an attack on democracy, it was an attack on the science. And it was all summarized by this mantra, trust the experts, okay, which was a new thing. That's not a thing. Trusting the experts is not a thing. It's not a, you know, it is that definitely not a feature of democracy, right? And it's not a feature of science. Everything in science is subject to question. Everything in democracy is subject to question. It is a feature of totalitarianism, and it is a feature of religion, but not science and democracy. And so when I kept hearing this from CNN every day, from everybody in the administration, oh, he's not trusting the experts, he's doing his own research.
Right.
He's doing his research. That became a crime. Doing your own research became a crime. And, you know, that's what you're supposed to do in a democracy.
Mr. Kennedy, you were writing about this and had been for years worried about vaccines, the contents, the consequences, and people could take issue with that. But we're talking about esteemed epidemiologists who run Stanford's epidemiology department.
Yeah.
Bob Ajari and a whole host of doctors and clinicians who are seeing the abnormalities.
Thousands and thousands of scientists. If you got injured by a COVID vaccine, you weren't allowed to talk about it. If your kid got injured, you weren't allowed to talk about it. You were censored from the internet. You couldn't talk about these injuries and deaths. These famous scientists, literally the best scientists in our country, were silenced. They were gagged.
How did that change?
They were discredited. Well, I had seen that for many years because I got involved in the vaccine debate early, and for me, it was a science exercise. I was reading the science. This is what I do for a living. I read science. I've had over 500 lawsuits. Virtually all of them involve scientific controversies. And what I do for a living is I read science critically. I read it and I look for the places where people cheat, which they do all the time in science. This is why I say trust the experts is not a thing. When I sued Monsanto, they had experts from Stanford, Harvard, and Yale. My wife, Cheryl Hines, came to the 2 days of trial when they were putting their witnesses on. She walked out and said, you know, why are you suing this poor company? They have these, they did nothing
wrong. Experts.
I said, just wait. And then she came, and we had Harvard science and Yale scientists, too, who were looking at the same information and saying something completely different. And the jury believed us and gave us $2.2 billion. Oh, you know, I read, this is what I do, I read science critically, and I was reading the science, and I was reading it for 12 years.
And you now believe Dr. Fauci should be jailed. You've said that, and you imply it in your book.
Yeah, I don't know if I actually said that, those words. Do I think that I could bring him in front of a jury and put him in jail? Yes, I do.
You would bend your DOJ if you were president in that
direction?
Well,
what I think is the best thing is that if we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like they've had in other parts of the world, where we tell everybody, okay, we're going to now have a forum where you can come and confess and tell the truth about everything you do without consequence. It's very important for the American public to see what happened, and that's much more important than putting somebody in jail, throwing them away, and you can prosecute them if they don't tell the truth or if they don't tell the whole thing. And so you have a process like that where everything comes out. What I want is complete transparency. I said yesterday, I'm going to put the entire government budget on blockchain.
I saw that.
It's visible to everybody. And if somebody, you know, if every item that is spent by the Pentagon will be on blockchain. So if somebody pays $16,000 for a toilet seat, Americans will be able to, there'll be 100 million eyes on that. Mm. And why did you do that? you know, and the Pentagon's never passed an audit. You know, none of these agencies do. So now we're going to have a full audit by the American public, and they'll be able to see where every dollar that they spend is spent. Mm.
Vis-a-vis that, President Biden, as you know, is part of that infrastructure bill, billions of dollars, trillion dollars, sent hundreds of millions to EV mandates and to green technologies. You don't support those mandates, which surprises me given your environmental record.
Well, I have to look at them. I have to look at them piece by piece. Here's what I would say. The biggest part of the infrastructure bill is for carbon capture and geoengineering. And I'm completely opposed to that. And I think carbon capture is just a huge subsidy for the carbon industry. And it allows them to continue to do something that is damaging to the environment. It poisons the water, poisons the air. You know, it sickens our kids, cuts down the Appalachian Mountain. Why are you subsidizing one of the richest industries in the world? And it is a mature industry. It's been around for hundreds of years. You don't give subsidies to it. There may be an argument for subsidizing a new industry that you're trying to jumpstart. You're trying to make sure that the United States is the centerpiece for that industry.
So the EV mandate you would support?
Well, I have to look at it. Each one I'm going to look at. Yeah. But, you know, listen.
I mean, it's Chinese cobalt mining, which
yeah,
are really
so
sanctioned.
Like I said, I would look at everything. But I'll tell you the principles that I will use to make those kind of decisions. When George Washington gave his inaugural address, he wanted to wear a suit that was made in America, but there were none. There was no apparel made in our country. So
no Brooks Brothers.
There was nothing. You know, everything, because it was a colonial model. We grew the cotton. We sent the cotton to England. Yeah. They turned it into apparel. They sent it back and sold it to us at a premium. And he said, we got to end that. We got to start our own apparel industry. And they began subsidizing and using tariffs, which were not market, you know, but to jumpstart it. And then within a decade, we were the biggest apparel producer in the world. So I think there is a good argument for subsidizing new industries to get them jump-started. But there is no argument for subsidizing a mature industry.
I was stunned to read that you would ban natural gas exports.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Our allies depend on that. Many of them don't have access. Otherwise, they're trying to get it from Russia or China or somebody else. And there's a national security question there. Why would you ban those exports?
Well, they can't. Europeans need ours because we blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. I don't have any problems with Europeans buying natural gas from Russia. You know, I would like to reduce the amount of natural gas used, but switch to other energy resources. But in our country, we have the Bakken Shale. We have a couple of shale beds that produce a lot of natural gas right now. So one of the biggest producers in the world. But it's very short-lived. We do not have the long-term deposits. And what they're seeing is that those deposits wane much quicker than they predicted. Within a year, they're already losing a lot of their volume. So we're not going to have, we don't have endless natural gas in this country. We're going to have to buy gas from Qatar, from Iran, and from Russia in a decade if we export ours. Right now, we have a huge advantage in our country with cheap natural gas that we make here. We should use that advantage to rebuild our industrial base because it gives us a competitive advantage around the world. We can power our industry at a tiny fraction of the cost that it costs in Europe to do it. So we need to take advantage of that. And, you know, if we're fracking wells and
you're against fracking as well.
No, I'm not against fracking. But what I say is the fracking industry ought to pay its costs. It ought to pay for the road destruction. It ought to use methodologies that don't poison the water, that reduce the pollution, that pay for the impacts on local communities, which are destroyed by fracking. And they shouldn't be able to do that anymore. But I'm not against it altogether, and I think that it's a huge advantage for us in rebuilding the industrial base in our country. We're going to give ourselves an advantage over the rest of the world, the cheapest energy in the world, which allows us to make finished products we can sell everywhere.
I've only got two quick questions for you. One, the border. You and I have both been down to the border. We know what a disaster this is. Joe Biden is now talking about granting amnesty to people who have repeatedly come across the border and been sent back, and those who forge documents. Would you support that?
No. I wouldn't.
But he's clearly trying to do that to hedge his bets, because my guess is he's then going to drop some enforcement mechanism. Do you oppose the wall? Are you opposed to the
wall? No. I think the wall, we need to finish the wall. There's about 27 gaps in the wall that, you've been down there, you can see.
Oh, and that's where they all come through.
They're all coming through. You don't need a wall 1,200 or 2,200 miles from Brownsville, Texas to San Diego. But you need that physical barrier in the urban areas where people can come across and disappear instantaneously. Mm-hmm. In the rural areas, you don't, but you need monitoring equipment. You need long-range cameras, you need sensors, you need videography, and you need lights.
Okay. And you support the wall as well. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I support the wall, completing the wall in the places like where it's needed.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about you in our remaining moments. Tell me what impact, if any, your grandmother's faith, your mother's faith, how did they shape your faith?
You know, the centerpiece of our lives was Catholicism. And, you know, I went when, you know, we said the rosary at least once a day, oftentimes three times a day. We prayed before and after every meal. We read the Bible every night. We read the lives of the saints. We read, and we went to church sometimes twice a day. So we would go to 7 o'clock Mass and 8 o'clock Mass in the summers. And it was our whole family. So, and it was really our whole community. So it was part of me growing up. Now, I became, after my dad died, when I was 15 years old, I became a drug addict.
Heroin.
And for 14 years, I was addicted to heroin. Oh, I was 28 years old. And during that period of time, I wouldn't say I lost my faith, but when you're living against conscience, which you have to do if you're, you know, if you're addicted to drugs, you push God out over the periphery of your horizon. So, the concept of God was, although it never was a race for me, it was just a distant concept that was not part of my day-to-day life. My recovery involved a profound spiritual realignment, which has been, again, the centerpiece of my life ever since. And I had a spiritual awakening very early in my recovery, which I was lucky about, because I no longer had to struggle with the compulsion.
Wow.
Take drugs, that was lifted away from me. But you can't live off the laurels of a spiritual awakening. You have to renew it every day, you renew it by, through service to other people.
Do you pray?
Do I pray? Yeah.
Every day?
I pray pretty much all day.
How has that led you down this path or sustained you in the dark days of this campaign? I know this can't be easy. You've got friends, you've got allies now coming at you, attacking you, attacking your reputation. Does your faith sustain you through that?
Yeah, it makes me peaceful, even when, I think of it as being like on the ocean during the storm when there's a tremendous amount of turbulence on the surface, but it allows me to sink below the surface and be in the stillness and to experience that, that stillness and the confidence that all of that is an illusion. It's all a distraction. And that, the important thing is me and my relationship with my higher power. Listen, every person that I admire throughout my life, including historical figures from Alexander the Great to Winston Churchill, my father, my uncle, all these other figures, and then, my sort of favorite saints, St. Francis of Assisi, St. Augustine.
I was going to end on your favorite saint.
All of them went through periods of their lives of public rejection, of rejection by their families, of rejection by their friends, of of being pariahs within their communities, and that in many ways their achievements were meaningful because of that, you know, social disdain that they experienced during parts of their life. So for me, you know, that I can look at this, you know, the rejection of the anger, and I don't carry around resentments. I don't carry around anger. Those things are corrosive to my own spirit. It's like swallowing poison and hoping someone else will die. Yeah. And I experience it as, you know, I need to welcome this. I need to embrace it. I need to say, you know, any time that anybody achieves something that is important, that this is part of the cost of it. Yeah. And so I can, you know, I can get through the day without being angry or resentful or feeling betrayed by people, and just understanding them and comprehending and trying my best to love.
Hmm. Robert Kennedy.
Thank you.
Good to meet you, Raymond.
That is all the time we have for now. Until next week, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for joining us. See you again next time. Bye now. We'll be right back.